Welcome to The Jewelry District, a podcast by JCK, brought to you by the De Beers Institute of Diamonds. Today, Rob Bates and Victoria Gamalski talk with Nancy Leach, co-founder of Gem Edge.
Hey everyone, welcome to The Jewelry District. This is Victoria Gamalski, editor-in-chief of JCK and jckonline.com, calling in from Los Angeles, and I'm with
Rob Bates, news director of JCK and jckonline.com, calling in from New York City.
Hi.
How's it going?
I'm a little tired. I was mentioning before we started taping that I took my son Nico to the ER last night for nothing. He's fine. He had abdominal pains and I wanted to rule out appendicitis, and he's back to his normal self. So we're all just super tired over here.
How long did you, was it quick or?
No, it was 3 hours. We got home after midnight, which I guess is probably about what you need to plan for when you go to the ER, right? About 3 hours minimum. Seems unfair. I think it's good training, though, because by the time people are listening to this podcast, I'm going to be in Geneva for Watches and Wonders, which is, of course, the annual watches coming out fair that used to be Basel World and is now growing in Geneva. It used to be SIHH, the Salon International de la Haute Horlogerie, and it was a real handful of prestige brands, and it's growing now. I don't think it'll ever quite be Basel World, but it's certainly expanding. And so I guess it's the fatigue from last night is good training, since I'll be hitting the ground running when I arrive on Monday, which is, of course, the eclipse. I keep thinking about it. Have you read or thought much about the eclipse that's going to cut through the middle of the country on Monday?
No, I just first I've heard of it. I feel pretty dumb now.
It's coming across. Like, I have friends who are going to Arkansas. I mean, of course, when people listen to this, it'll have passed already. But anyway, I'm excited that we have, I love, love, love speaking to people who have a read on things coming down the pike or kind of a look to the horizon as part of their business. And today we have somebody who really has specialized in forecasting and trend publications and looking ahead for much of her career. I'll just tee her up now since here we are, but we've got somebody who I worked with, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago when we did JCK Rockstar, which was a very fun but brief interlude where JCK and Swarovski partnered on a reality series. And her name is Nancy Leach. She's now co-founder of Gem Edge, which is a consultancy trend forecasting service and publishers of a publication called Gem Edge that really looks around the industry and taps into all the things the rest of us need to be thinking about. So welcome, Nancy. I just loved speaking to people like you. So I'm so happy to have you here. And you're calling in from, you're in Austria, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Austria. I live in Austria. I'm Canadian, actually, but I moved to Austria, I have to say, about 25 years ago when I started at Swarovski.
So is that quite mountainous? Because I've been to Austria, but just to Vienna, is Innsbruck, like, are you right there in like Alpine village?
Yeah, surrounded by mountains, beautiful. And I think it's number one in tourism. So a lot of people come here just for the skiing.
Wow. Well, so you mentioned Canadian in London, Ontario. So tell us, what's your background? And then we'll hear the story of how you got into jewelry.
Well, I have to say I started quite young. So besides school, I was working at like 16, and my brother-in-law had a small family-run jewelry in London, Ontario. So of course, I always worked there on the weekends or after school. And I think one of my first instances, he kind of felt after kind of trained me and worked me in with the diamonds and the gemstones. And I always came in, and I remember if it was like it was yesterday, I always came in with this and tried on this beautiful sapphire square princess cut diamond surrounding it ring. And that's what I wore around the store. And I felt like the queen. And for some reason that night he left and thought he could leave us alone. And I put the ring back. I just thought, tonight I'll put it back in. And I have to say 10 minutes later, we got robbed. Yeah, okay. Two guys came into the store and they asked to see a ring. And we kind of, the three of the girls that were there just kind of felt we weren't too comfortable and we didn't want to take anything out of the showcase. And then they just started smashing everything.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Hear about that.
So it was okay. It was an experience. And then afterwards with the police and how they go about it, it was definitely another experience being so young. But
how old were you?
I was probably 16, 17.
Oh, wow.
But it made me stay in the industry because I felt like I'm not going to let people like that drive me out of the business. And, as I got older and I worked for Burps, which most people know in Canada, probably about for 8 years. And that's where I got most of my training, especially in diamonds and, you know, retail selling, telling stories, you know, going through the whole, you know, the four C's and being able to sell engagement rings. So it was my whole process. I probably learned back from in Burps.
And so, yeah. So then how did you go from Burks to Swarovski? And then was your first job with Swarovski when you moved to Austria?
Well, actually, no, I stayed in Canada. So when I started, Swarovski didn't have jewelry. So it was at the very beginning where they did more of the crystal figurines and Burks carried the collection. And then they slowly introduced some of the fashion jewelry. So I think, I don't know if any of you remember where they used to have Savvy. That's what one of the first ones they started with, the first collections, and then they actually rebranded and made it the Swarovski collection. So I was responsible for developing in the Western part of Canada, you know, with the independent retailers, introducing the jewelry to the silver crystal collection and also to their members. And I remember back then it was a lot of romancing the collectors and the independent retailers. We had a lot of customization, personalization. You know, some of the designers would come in and we would specially set, you know, some of the brooches that we did. So it was just a really great introduction back then.
I guess you started at retail and did you eventually move to corporate?
Exactly. So I was lucky enough to get the chance to move to Austria. And move into marketing, it was a little bit of a shock because I was traveling a lot. So we were going from retailer to retailer, meeting so many amazing people. It was always different. And then you come into an office setting, into marketing, and staying in one place, that was a little bit of a change.
And this was like the late 90s. So I'm just trying to imagine all the changes that you experienced in your career. I mean, the jewelry industry went through so much in those early aughts, you know, with the introduction of online retail and, of course, the growth of the fashion business. And you were always in the marketing communications end of Swarovski?
Yeah, I stayed there. So when I first started, I worked very closely together with Nadia Swarovski, where it was the beginning and the introduction of what we call the creative service centers. So this is, I think, when she started, she really wanted to get back to the roots and the DNA of Swarovski, of working with young designers, working with design houses, and, you know, introducing innovations, the loose components into the houses to really get them to work with the product, but also support them on their journey and kind of realize their creativity. So that's where I kind of started within the marketing department. So it was always working very closely with whether it was fashion designers, shoe designers, jewelry designers, and trying to make their dreams come true.
And people don't realize this, but Swarovski was one of the first companies to kind of dabble, or even actually more than dabble, in lab-grown diamonds.
Yeah. So as you know, my years went on and I moved to different parts of the company and experienced parts of the company, I ended with the gemstone business. So that's, as Rob, as you rightly said, you know, we really just were responsible for the sales and marketing of genuine gemstones and also created stones. And that's when the great topic of lab-created diamonds came into play. I have to say it was also 16 years ago almost that Swarovski started working with the material. You know, Swarovski was always about, and always will be about, innovation. So being an early adopter with such an amazing material was something that they wanted and needed to explore.
And did it take off right away?
No. I think there was a lot of, and there still is, I mean, still being so involved in all the conversations, you know, it was just finding that niche, you know, what fit to the brand, what, you know, was the strategy. Back then, it was so new to the industry that it was really trying to speak to, you know, to the consumers and seeing how the consumers would react and accept the material. And it's only now been many years later that the consumers are starting to accept the lab-grown diamonds.
you know, there's probably so much we could ask you about Swarovski, but I think because you're working with GemEd, or, you know, you've co-founded GemEd, and it takes so much of what you learned and took away from your years at Swarovski. And, you know, I think we're very keen to hear some of your big thoughts on some of these emerging topics we're all dealing with, including, of course, lab-grown. Do you want to maybe tell us about GemEd, and then we can touch back on the future of lab-grown as you see it and how you advise GemEd's customers and clients?
Well, you know, part of the responsibility also that I had was working on the trends. So fine jewelry trends together with Birgit and Vivian Becker. So the three of us are now working together on GemEd.
And that's Birgit Reeder. And then Vivian Becker, you mentioned, and I, of course I saw that in your marketing materials. She's of course a wonderful writer, a London-based, super well-established content authority in the jewelry and gem world. And Birgit, I wasn't familiar with, but she was a colleague at Swarovski?
Yep, exactly. So she also worked, I want to say, 18 to 20 years at Swarovski. So we started working on trends together and always, you know, observing the market, what's coming. So it's been many years of doing that. And really, it's just something that we love. And it's just something that comes natural. And it's something that, you know, I think, even though we have all of these topics of AI and ChatGPT and being able to, you know, have user generated content, you know, there's still that need for humanized predictions, because I think especially in the fine jewelry industry, the know-how is not always in the internet.
And is the GemEd, the publication, I guess it's called GemEd 2025 Plus, that did that just come out earlier this year?
It just came out earlier this year in February, only launched digitally because we don't want to print anything. You know, it's all sustainability and really, you know, trends are so fast. When we first started, you could, you know, really have an outlook 5 years ahead, but that's just not possible anymore. And, you know, things change so often. And what we did really differently with the publication is really make it interactive. So when you dive into the publication, so you can really experience, you know, designer interviews, some videos, we have Muzo, so you can actually, you know, look at the minds. You know, I think it's just really having the content and bringing the content to life.
Well, one of the things, because I, you know, you and I spoke for a separate article I was writing about the future of lab grown. And so maybe this is a good moment to pick up this thread again. You really fascinated me with your thoughts on how the future of lab grown might actually reside in just allowing designers much more creativity. It wasn't so much focused on value or price, but on what you could do with lab grown that, you know, you simply can't do with natural. I'd love for you to elaborate on that and talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing and what news and what companies you're drawing on to have these kinds of ideas about lab grown. Like, who is it that you're paying attention to that's doing cool stuff?
I have to say, today I went back and had a little bit of a look at the past and where this creativity really started. I mean, that was one thing at the very beginning where we looked at in the past, like, what could you do with lab grown diamonds that is very challenging with natural diamonds? And, you know, working with colors, that was one thing. So we see now, you know, Fred Jewelry, they just focused on working with blue. So blue diamonds. So I think back in 2018, we saw Jonathan Ive and Mark Newson, they launched like a full lab grown ring. And I think that was really, for me, the start of where the innovation happened, that you could play more freely with lab grown diamonds. And unfortunately, it's happening in bits and pieces. And I just love to what the Future Rock, actually together with Lightbox, just launched, I want to say last week, or in the process of launching, even though they used lab grown sapphire for the shank of the ring, it's still totally creative. It's not the same use and really mirroring what natural diamonds are doing. It's just really finding a completely new expression and giving the designers the freedom just to play.
I mean, I agree. I think that's a huge potential market for lab grown. A lot of people agree with that. And yet you speak to some of these companies that are very involved in the market or selling to majors, and they say there's not a demand for that in the market, that people still want the kind of tried and true. They basically want to imitate what natural diamonds do. Are you starting to see that shift a little bit?
I've been hearing that argument since the beginning of my time. I think it's always an argument. I think people are too scared to veer off into a new direction. But we see some of the younger brands who are actually entering into the lab-grown space, and they are playing, they are having fun. I mean, I go back, and this is what we talked about, Victoria, about Unsaid. I just love what they're doing. They're maintaining their DNA of their company, which is anchored in natural diamonds. So they're cutting expertise, but they're doing this and applying it to lab grown. So they have their Unsaid brand. They're applying their DNA of what they can do best and having a little bit fun and being unique.
This podcast is brought to you by the De Beers Institute of Diamonds. The De Beers Institute of Diamonds' mission is to grow and strengthen consumer confidence by providing integrity across the natural diamond industry, offering unrivaled diamond grading and testing exclusively for natural, untreated diamonds. The De Beers Institute of Diamonds provides diamondaires with confidence in a report of each diamond's four C's. Every diamond graded at De Beers Institute of Diamonds is also given a unique inscription number, allowing the diamond's details to be tracked and viewed on their website. Visit institute.debeers.com to learn more and register for their grading services.
Any other kind of cutting-edge lab-grown companies that are on your radar?
I mean, like I said, the platform, The Future Rocks, they're yes. just dedicated to lab-grown diamonds, and they just launched a collection with Lightbox, which I think is fantastic. Again, they use color. They use color lab-grown diamonds. The Shank is just from a lab-grown sapphire, which again gives a lot of freedom of creativity. We see also the commercial, you know, Kimai, of course, Pandora with their lab-grown, Swarovski coming out with their lab-grown. For me, it's just the creativity. I just the more that you can play with new cuts, play with different cuts, it doesn't have to imitate natural ground diamonds. And I'm very much for trying to have a different approach.
There's a lot of debate about what market share lab growns have. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, naturally, a lot of it is in the US. I hear all the discussions that are going on. I follow it quite close. As I said to Victoria, I think the biggest topic for me, what's going to maybe be a game changer, I don't know how much you follow it, Rob, is the diamond standard. This with Cormac McKinney, I think this is for natural diamonds and making a commodity. This is, for me, an interesting spin that's maybe going to really differentiate the two materials.
And Nancy, what else? Like, when you're grappling with either your next trend forecast or just trying to stay on top of what you think you need to be including in your consultancy and your forecasting services, like, I want to know what's drawing your attention these days. I mean, aside from lab grown, since we've talked about a little bit here.
Besides lab grown, I really see, I mean, naturally, the digitalization, the wearables that are coming into play. I mean, well-being and wellness is a huge topic. We watch this very closely just because of the gemstones, the natural gemstones themselves. They have a lot of meaning. They have a lot of ancient, I would say, medicinal meaning. And we're seeing a lot of collections, whether it's jewelry, whether it's wellness products, that are starting to bring gemstones into play. There's quite a few cosmetic brands in the US and also in Europe. I don't consider them startups anymore because they're pretty much anchored as far as whether it's creams with diamonds and gold. You see a lot of, I would say, facial masks with rose quartz. So there's a lot of the healing gemstones that are more so in powders. So they're not as we would consider them in jewelry, so larger pieces. So it's a lot of cosmetic grade powders that are coming into play.
I remember a water bottle company, I want to say it was like Vita Water or Vita Jewel. Exactly. Or something.
Vita Jewel, I think it's called.
Yeah, that had like crushed gemstones at the bottom of these bottles that sort of purported to, you know, imbue the drinker, I guess, with some of these health and wellness properties associated with these stones. It seemed like good spa products, and maybe as ancillary retail jewelry products, maybe if you had a sort of a little lifestyle space. But yeah, do you see jewelers jumping on these? Or
yeah, I haven't seen jewelers jump on this yet, but I mean, let's face it, I mean, jewels and the gemstones have kind of gone beyond the traditional classical wearing of, you know, earrings, necklaces, bracelets. We're jeweling our eyewear. You know, people are putting diamonds in their teeth. This is not something new. I just think that we can have a little bit more fun. And I think we're in the age where, especially after, you know, we hear it, COVID and COVID, we're having a little bit more fun. We're talking about digital jewelry. We're talking about going back, you know, to the senses. And I think this is what jewelry does. It heightens our senses. It brings us closer and makes us calmer, this is what lab grown is. And, you know, women aren't waiting for the men to buy their diamonds anymore. And people are self-purchasing. And it's not just women. So we're all self-purchasing. And this is the best time for jewelry. I think also jewels will be and continue to be, you know, the height of self-expression for everybody. We see the piercings. I think it's just incredible.
Well, you mentioned digital jewelry. And I remember there was a moment during maybe the first wave of lockdowns in 2020 where there was a lot of ideas coming around about, you know, your avatars and what kind of jewelry they might wear in the metaverse. And then we all got back to being in person, and it felt like maybe that was just a brief moment, a kind of a gimmicky time when we all thought maybe, yes, the future of our coexistence on this planet would be digital. Do you still think there's like that we need to talk about the metaverse, think about the metaverse, start worrying about how we're going to bejewel ourselves in the metaverse? Or is that something from a retro vision of the past that doesn't apply anymore?
No, I think it's still there. I think it'll be, I mean, if you just think about the gaming industry alone, I just looked at the figures today. They're saying by 2030, it's going to grow another 15% to almost $700 billion. You know, the gaming industry, people spend a lot of time gaming with their friends. They don't go out. The younger generations, they're more online than they are physical. So the digital jewelry and bringing these two worlds together, the physical and the digital, is still going to be a huge topic. And I think we want to negate it, or we don't want to think about it just because jewelry is just a physical thing, but it's still a huge topic.
What is the current importance of networks like Instagram and TikTok as far as jewelry sales?
You know, a lot of people that we talk to, you know, still TikTok is very important, you know, especially for growth of younger businesses. I think it depends the direction also of what happens with legislation with TikTok in the US. I think also we've talked to Quinn May a lot. She's a consultant, digital consultant in the US, and she's also interviewed in the publication. She kind of feels also, and so do we, it's, you know, retailers and brands are going back to personalization and loyalty and being in direct contact with their customers. And so we're, you know, we're kind of reverting back to emails and newsletters and direct WhatsApp. So we kind of feel like we're going back to having a little bit more personal contact, targeted contact, more so than these, you know, let's throw it out there and hope it works.
And one of the things I've noticed over the years is that sometimes there's trends towards bigger diamonds and bigger looks and flashier looks. And then you read that people want to tone it down because it's hard economic times or the culture kind of calls for that. What's your sense of the vibe right now?
I think it's going to be location, I have to say. I mean, we're seeing that India is on the rise of being the next luxury target market. I think that's still they're very culturally anchored to jewelry. They have a huge rise of the middle class, whereas I just read on the weekend that the middle class in the US is disappearing. So I think it's going to be, it depends on what regions. I mean, China's always been, you know, because of the petite look, they don't wear as big. I think we're going to see a little bit of a shift. People, especially in the US, the luxury consumer, they're still going to wear big. They're still going to buy the bigger diamonds, but they're going to want something a little bit, I think, globally. And this is what we see, you know, the return of the goldsmith, these, you know, innovative materials, something a little bit different, but they want uniqueness. And I think this is what we have to remember, whether it's not about the material and this constant battle between the materials. It's really about the uniqueness and the creative expression and innovation and being innovative and giving the customer what they want, giving the customer that choice. I think that's what the industry has always been about. We see the creative freedom that the high jewelers and the creative directors have had in the last couple of years is just fantastic. So I kind of wish we could focus on that creativity and whether we see larger or smaller stones. I think it also comes in cycles. I don't see the larger stones disappearing, especially color. I think we're going to really see the return of playing with colored gemstones.
What do you see right now coming up that's going to be hot? What should people be looking out for?
That is a good question. We've talked about so much. I always come back to, I see a lot of unisex jewelry. I think it's no longer just for men or for women. I think the designs that are coming out into the market really reflect this, whether it's, I see what David Yurman's doing, also being able to tell stories. The jewelry has become a lot more fun, has a little bit of a story attached to it, kind of interacts with the consumer. And in addition to that, the art jewels. The jewels have become little works of art, regardless if they're really small or made with big stones. So I see really these three kind of buckets, whether it's, again, the unisex jewels. And I go back to it's not about the material. I think it's about how creative the brands are telling their stories, and even the independent jewelers and in the jewelry pieces that they're producing, just the uniqueness of them.
Okay, well, there you go. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us late in your day.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The Jewelry District. I'm Natalie Comet, the producer of the podcast. Our editor is Riley McCaskill. Any views expressed in this podcast do not reflect the opinion of JCK, its management, or its advertisers. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us next time on The Jewelry District by JCK.